Dramatist Anna Deavere Smith has spent her career bringing extraordinary stories about everyday life to the stage. Many of her plays are crafted from interviews with ordinary people about issues affecting America. Awards for her documentary approach include a National Humanities Medal and a MacArthur Fellowship. She visited the University of Kansas to deliver the Hall Center for the Humanities lecture in May 2015 when she was focused on her pipeline project, which has since spawned her 2016 play, Notes from the Field. But I also got her to talk about her 2006 book of advice on making a life in the arts for actors, performers, writers, and artists of every kind. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air, and here's Anna Deavere Smith on Letters to a Young Artist.
I wanted to make something that actors and other artists could, like, on a really low day, just open it up on any page and feel good. Or if they ran into a friend who got rejected for some reason, or they're about to just give it up, who would take out a worn copy of the book and tear out a page and say, you need to read this. So really was trying to write something encouraging for artists of all ages, thinking about Rilke calling it Letters to a Young Poet.
Well, that makes sense to me then, why you titled each of the little sections of it with confidence, self-esteem, discipline, failure, things like that, so that you could go back to it and have something to perk you up when you're feeling down.
It's the same way some people call a friend, or, you know, some people listen to a song. I used to listen to Gloria Gaynor's I Will Survive, you know, before those horrific auditions that I've never come to enjoy.
Well, I thought I would get you to read a little bit from the book, Letters to a Young Artist.
Okay. When I put this book together, I decided to arrange the letters not chronologically, but more or less according to certain topics that tend to emerge when artists talk shop to one another. In the case of most artists, of course, talking shop also means talking goals, dreams, philosophies, ideals. I know that dreams motivate us, but I believe it is your vision as well as your dreams that will make you an artist, perhaps even a great artist. Cornel West, another scholar, told me eloquently that hope calls for a leap of faith that goes beyond the evidence to create new possibilities based on visions that become contagious. These visions, he says, allow people to engage in heroic actions, always against the odds, no guarantee whatsoever. People who run schools and cities and institutions don't want to bank on art because there's no guarantee that it will help make test scores or anything else any better. Sometimes I think they don't want to bank on art because there's never any guarantee that it will sell. But if you're like me, you're drawn to the idea of the seer who makes visions that become contagious, visions that allow people to engage in heroic actions. It's the allowing that art makes possible. We traditionally think it's the patron who gives the artist an allowance. Yet it's the artist who gives society a large allowance. The artist gives us the allowance to imagine things another way. I was trained at a time when artists were thought to be special people. I don't think we're so special. I think the world around us is incredibly special, incredibly magnificent in its lightness and its darkness and most ordinary muted parts. I'm looking to speak in this book to you brave folk, younger than I, who are trying to express something that you feel will make a difference in the way this earth stays in orbit. I'm trying to make a call with this book to you young brave hearts who would like to find new collaborations with scholars, with business people, with human rights workers, with scientists, and more, to make art that seeks to study and inform the human condition, art that is meaningful.
That's just a little bit from the last part of the preface to Letters to a Young Artist by Anna Deavere Smith, who's talking with me today here at the Hall Center for the Humanities on the KU campus. I like that because you bring to light something that you're all about, which has to do with collaboration. And the fact that you see that art is all around you in the most ordinary things. Elsewhere in your writing, you talk about Walt Whitman just briefly and about how he saw the multitudes and how that was important to his work, but it is to yours too. And so your whole life you've gone around and interviewed people and listened to what they've had to say. And then you're doing plays out of people's stories. The thing I'm most curious about, though, is that you talk about taking what they say verbatim, even down to the us, and perform those in front of people. But there's crafting. Tell me a little bit about how interview people.
Well, I mean, the notion that there couldn't be craft, which I guess some people have thought over time, just blows my mind. I mean, I start with a lot of material, usually for most of the works, at least 300 interviews. So that's 300 hours or more. And I travel all over the place to do it. For Let Me Down Easy, I did interviews on three continents.
Let Me Down Easy has to do with healthcare in America.
So I have a lot of material. I have to study to talk to a lot of the people that I'm talking to. I have to make a team of people to help me put all that together. Got to raise money. And then I have all this stuff, and I try to pick out parts of it that are going to make sense and then link them together, either, as in the case of some of my earlier plays, to tell a story, or in the case of Let Me Down Easy or my new play on the school-to-prison pipeline, there is no story. It is a matter. It is an issue. It is a current problem. So I'm making a kind of bigger picture than most of us experience when we read the paper or argue about it. So I have to figure out how to make these disparate parts make sense. And there needs to be a kind of emotional roller coaster so that the audience feels that they're having a different experience watching me than they would have, say, reading a study.
Well, going back again to your technique, you interview people for an hour, and then do you transcribe what they had to say?
I do my own transcriptions now.
Oh, my God.
Well, I don't transcribe the whole thing.
Okay.
I only transcribe what I'm going to use. Occasionally, if there's more money, I have the whole thing transcribed. But that's a lot of dough. So we don't usually spend the money on that. With this new project, we want to do transcriptions because we'd like to make an archive. Right now, all kinds of people are having questions about mass incarceration. It is a moment in time that we have a chance to do something about social and racial inequity, even though we're shocked that it's still here. And so I would like people who care about that to have access to these phenomenal conversations that I've been able to have with people, many of whom are doing really good work. You may not know about it because they're not TV stars or movie stars. And so I think that there's just great ideas out there that I would not be able to share in the course of 90 minutes, which is usually how long a play is. I want people to know about them. And they can listen for themselves. You know, maybe I'll write a book, maybe I won't, but I'd give them a chance to make up their own mind before I put my stamp on it.
So this Schools to Prison, is that what it's called, Schools to Prison
Pipeline?
Well,
I'm just calling it the Pipeline Project, but it centers around what has been named the School-to-Prison Pipeline, which is really coming from statistics that the United States Department of Justice has accumulated that tell us that, first of all, starting with no-tolerance policies, which we date back to the tragedies in Columbine in the 90s, that zero-tolerance policies have sort of proliferated in schools, particularly public schools. You know that some of these schools have police officers in them. And that kids in this circumstance, in poverty, are punished more severely for things that in some environments would call mischief. You know, and these environments become pathologies, and after a certain number of suspensions, we can predict that they'll end up in juvenile hall. But that, first of all, that suspension as a form of discipline is being overused, as is expulsion. But that after a certain number of suspensions and expulsions, the likelihood that a person will spend part of their lives in the criminal justice system is pretty clear. And as one of my favorite people, the Chief Justice of the State of California, Kantil Sakaui, said to me, you know, if you're not in school, you're in trouble. You know, they're not doing well anyway. Then why would we put them outside of the school where they are unsupervised, and particularly in communities that are already vulnerable and stressed? Think of all the kinds of things that can happen to them and what they might do. So that's how I started looking at the pipeline. And then, you know, people who are more in the area of psychology or even sociology might say, well, it's a womb to prison pipeline. But people would say, it's a cradle to prison pipeline. And then on the other extreme, I started to hear about projects of universities like my university, NYU, going into prisons to create college courses. So then we could say, well, that's a pipeline from prison to college. So I like to think now about the pipeline as a spectrum of opportunity, and that we as Americans can decide where we're going to intervene. Are we going to intervene and disrupt the pipeline from the cradle to high school, or the cradle to community college, or the cradle to a job? Or are we going to intervene when there's something wrong to try to clean up the obstacles, to make sure that people can make their way to health, joy, and intellectual understanding and meaning?
You know, one of the people that you brought to light in the performance, I was so moved by the principal.
Linda Wayman, she's a principal at Strawberry Mansion School in North Philadelphia, a very, very compromised community.
Yeah.
Very poor.
That was so incredibly powerful, I thought. Is that going to be published at any time?
Go to www.neh.gov, because I did perform Miss Wayman as a part of the 2015 Jefferson Lecture.
Here's the end of Anna Deavere Smith's portrayal of Linda Wayman, who also appears in her play, Notes from the Field.
But if we don't, as a society, find this compassion to say, okay, it's my job to get one kid back on the road. They're not lost. They're wandering. They just lost their direction. Trying to get somebody to listen to them. Can somebody please help me back on the road? I'm lost. There's nobody out there to lend them a hand and say, the street that you need is that one right there. For my students, wandering starts very early, first grade, second grade, definitely third grade. And I believe I was put here on this earth at this time, on this day, to come into this community and inspire some hope in people who have lost hope. And worse than that, never had any. They were not even born with hope. I was at a college the other day. Miss Wayman, we got a surprise for you. I said, you do? And I walked in there, and there was one of my old students. Oh, she was awful in school. I walked in there. I said, Joselle, you never told me you were going to college? She said, Miss Wayman, I just want to thank you. And she was awful. And just to see, and Joe said, when I tell you she was terrible, wouldn't go to school, hanging out with the boys, and to walk in there, I said, just one, Jesus. Just one. That's the way I look at it. Just one. I'm not trying to do the masters. I'm trying to save one at a time. And I think if everybody say in their mind, just one kid. If I could say something nice today to just one kid, it'd be a better world.
Anna Deavere Smith as Miss Wayman. Her full presentation at the 2015 National Endowment for the Humanities Jefferson Lecture is at neh.gov. This is New Letters on the Air. Smith was also awarded the 2012 Medal for the Humanities by President Obama.
The Medal for the Humanities is given at the same time as that for the arts, but I was recognized in the humanities, which is really very meaningful to me because, you know, when I was young and really kind of starting out in the quote-unquote business, I knew that I wanted to do something that was about America. And that's why I titled my whole project, you know, now about 18 plays, On the Road, A Search for American Character. And one of the biggest compliments I got when I was a young teacher, didn't even have tenure yet, was somebody from the American Studies Association called me up out of the blue and said, we'd like you to come to our conference. And I was like, really? Because I was like in the drama department, that thing that's way over there that does those plays, and some people know about it and some people don't. It's a big musical, everybody knows. Otherwise, they don't know on a campus. I thought, wow, me? I said, really? I always think they must have the wrong Anna Deavere Smith. And he said, well, you are an Americanist.
People must really open up to you when you talk to them.
Well, first of all, by now, having done this for a very long time, since the late 70s, I think the first part is finding somebody who wants to talk. I don't chase people, not like the media. And so I try to find issues that people want to talk about. And then I find the people who, they would be screaming it from a mountaintop and I'd be passing by and I happen to catch it. And so that's how I feel about myself now. It's more like journalism. You know, I'm not sent to necessarily do a portrait, but I'm going to go and look and find. You know, Miss Wayman, Linda Wayman, is very gifted as a talker. And, you know, she really is in the midst of a crisis that she's working really hard to turn around. And so one of the things I do know about people is that some people, it's almost like they're sponges for the environment around them and just are able to accumulate the words that really describe what's going on. And they kind of have internal editing machines. They didn't go to school to study it. They just are like that. And those are the people that I'm looking for, and I find them.
So at what point did you know that doing these portraits of Americans was going to be your life's work?
You know, you never really know what you're doing. I just know that I spent a lot of time thinking about language. And my grandfather had said when I was a girl, if you say a word often enough, it becomes you. And then I had had this sort of extraordinary experience while studying some language of Queen Margaret in Shakespeare's play, Richard III. And I now know, thanks to one of our brilliant Shakespeare scholars, Marjorie Garber at Harvard, that the thing that was going on, to use Marjorie Garber's words, with Queen Margaret was that by the time we meet her in Richard III, she's already been in the Henry plays and been powerful and beautiful and all this stuff. By the time we meet her in Richard III, she's old and withered and, you know, many horrible things have happened to her. And she's done many horrible things. And Marjorie Garber used these words about her, this used up, condemned to words person. I just learned this year when I was preparing for the Jefferson lecture. I thought, oh my God, that is what I have been looking for all these years. When I tell you the people who would scream from a mountaintop, they're not used up necessarily, but they're in a moment in their life that something's happened to them or something that's happened to the world that they have nothing to resort to but their words. So I think, first of all, that experience that I had with Queen Margaret when I was in acting school was a problem I was trying to solve way back then. And I wanted people, because I decided I'm not going to be a Shakespeare scholar, because I thought, I wish I could get people to talk to me like Queen Margaret. And so I just started randomly interviewing people. And then I met a linguist at a party, which is what I had originally wanted to be in college. And then she said, what do you do? And I never want to say an actor, even now, because people say ridiculous things like, what have I seen you in? And at that time, nobody would have seen me in much of anything. And so I said, well, you know, I'm really interested in trying to get people to talk. And she said, well, I'm going to give you three questions that you can use. And they were, have you ever come close to death? Have you ever been accused of something that you didn't do? And do you know the circumstances of your birth? So I got this idea to put together a play where other actors would play these people, because my theory was I could get them to appear to be these people if I found the language which would take them there. And so I would walk up to people in the streets of New York, this is like in 1982, and say, I know an actor who looks like you. If you give me an hour of your time, I'll invite you to see yourself performed. And I'd talk to them about anything they were doing. In the course of the interview, no matter what they did, I would say, well, have you ever come close to death? And I would watch that the linguist was right, that when I asked those questions, they became more expressive and more original than they had been in the rest of the interview. And wow, that their language would sort of fall apart. And Bertolt Brecht wrote about this same phenomenon in an essay called Street Scene, where he says if you go out into the street after an accident, you say what happened, people will play the play of what happened. It's that idea of you have nothing but your words. You might have now a video to show. But before this technology, I would say people were probably better storytellers because they had nothing but their words to create the scene for you of something that was unimaginable. So that people will, when asked those questions, particularly very verbal people, will start to perform. My plays about the riots are all about Have you ever been accused of something you didn't do? When you think about it, that's what justice is. You feel that it's not fair. You're in a situation for something you didn't create, and now you have to fix it. That's that question. The play about healthcare was about death. Have you ever come close to death?
Exactly.
The birth one, I haven't really dealt with it, although it is the end of my play, Fires in the Mirror, where a father of a boy who was killed in a way that sparked a riot in Crown Heights, I put him at the end of the play because he says, nobody's going to push me around. I'm a special person. I was born by my foot. You know, he came out foot first.
One of your earlier plays, Piano, is set in Cuba.
Yeah.
Do you see this having a resurgence?
It's so funny. I kind of gave up on that play because I felt that I couldn't be respected enough in the American theater for presenting a play about Cuba because I'm not Cuban. In my generation, it was like, if you're black, you write about black people. Skip Gates, in one of his very important books, said that most African-American people's first works are autobiographical. Mine are not. I went the other way. I went to that thing which is not me. But there is this expectation that you are going to write about you, as though you don't have the imagination to conceive of something else. It's the beginning of the end of empathy. And that play is not based on interviews. It's
That's a play
all out of my head.
Well, you just mentioned empathy, and I know that I marked a piece in Letters to a Young Artist that has to do exactly with empathy.
Okay. Well, I believe that fundamental to being an artist is understanding the position of an artist, rehearsing that position, and practicing that position. It's from that position that you will develop an eye, an ear, and a heart. These three organs are essential. Yes, as a painter, you will need a hand, and as an actor, I need a voice and a body. But before getting to those, we need to develop the eye, the ear, the heart. We do that by learning how to step outside of given situations to watch, listen, and to feel as others as much as to feel things about others. Feeling as others is empathy. Feeling for others is sympathy. Empathy is more useful and more important. It requires more rigor. That rigor will make you stronger of heart and spirit. Empathy requires a very highly developed imagination. It is more active than sympathy. It requires more intellectual development. Sympathy, to me, is just tears. Empathy is potentially very productive. Stepping outside gives you the space to watch, listen, feel. To step outside, you must suspend opinions and judgments. It doesn't mean that you're devoid of them. It means that you can control them long enough to watch, listen, and feel. You store what you've learned, and then you do what you will with what you've gathered.
That was another passage from the book Letters to a Young Artist, and I'm talking with Anna DeVere Smith. It's from the chapter Being in It and Out of It at the Same Time. This is New Letters on the Air, and we're at the Hall Center for the Humanities on the University of Kansas campus.
It's also about that we're out and in, right? We're not really completely in. So one of the things I love to quote, and even created an entire course based on Mary Ellen Mark, a great photographer, in the catalog for her exhibition, American Odyssey, wrote that the camera gives her the necessary distance to get close to people. So in my case, the way that I've taught myself to listen, it's not sympathetic. It is clinical, actually. But it's from that distance that I'm able to get close. And I need that distance because, you know, first of all, I'm making decisions about that soon, what's going to be in the play, or somebody will say something like, for example, you know, the end of Linda Wayman was just one kid. And the audience always responds to that. So yet, 2 days ago, I was in Baltimore.
Which is your hometown.
Which is my hometown. And there was recently a race riot in Baltimore because of the death of a young man called Freddie. And so while the director, Marin Alsop, was talking about the Baltimore Symphony and a project that they have called Orchids, she used this expression, you know, if we can just take one kid and really turn them on to music and start talking about this boy who was very angry, and they brought him into their world, their Orchids project, and he's this great percussionist, and he's been with them for 9 years. And so I said, you know, say a little bit more about that. Talk a little bit more about that one kid, because I know that I'll maybe be able to weave that in to this bigger idea than just one kid. Doesn't even mean just like you as you, but you could do something with this that will magnify that. Or here's an instance where it's not just some, you know, one kid that you pick up and take to the park. No, she's in a position that she's got a project that went from 30 kids to 1,000 kids that the Baltimore Symphony is bringing into the world of classical music and to becoming musicians and all of the things that that means. During the riot, Symphony just went outside and impromptu started playing,
oh,
and 1,000 people showed up. A quintet went downtown to Pennsylvania Avenue and North Avenue across from where the CVS burned down and just sat down and started playing music. So that this notion of the just one kid is much bigger than charity, right? And so that's why I have to be out and in at the same time. I have to really watch what they're saying because I'm trying to write even then. So yeah. That's what distance does.
You're doing a lot of what it is that I think people in public radio want to do. You know, I think of StoryCorps, mm-hmm. David Isay's project to tell people's stories, which is bringing those stories to people too. Were you ever interested in radio?
I think
all?
It's all about access. And, you know, that thing that Marianne Alsop is talking about is access. So I didn't have access to anything other than my theater training to do anything. I spent so many hours in my railroad flat on Amsterdam Avenue in New York before it got gentrified in this dark room just listening to stuff, whether it was Alan Lomax, great musicologist, whether it was FDR's Fireside Chats. I was just listening to stuff. And I'll never forget the day, at that time, if you wanted to work as an actor at my level, we had these ridiculous little postcards with our picture on them. And most of my friends who were successful were very disciplined about every week thinking of something charming to write to a casting director on these things. And they all end up in the trash. And I remember the day when I picked up all of those and I threw them in the trash. And I said, I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to sit in this room and listen to either people who have talked to me or have talked to other people who are really good at getting people to talk, and I don't know what's going to come of it.
Wow.
And
that was your epiphany.
That was it. I played a part of a woman that I met in a temp job called Julia, who worked at JCPenney's, very animated African-American woman. I played one part. I directed this massive thing with 20 people, playing 20 people who I'd interviewed. And when those 20 people walked into this loft down on Leonard Street, that choreographer, that lifeguard, that hairstylist walked in there, and they sat down on the floor and started watching my actors do them. That was the epiphany. That's what I wanted to make. But I couldn't think of, again, access. I was like, how will I pay them? So then I remembered, oh, I was a mimic when I was a girl. I'll just do all the parts until I can figure out how to raise money. And then I will be able to have a company of people who will go on the road with me and find America.
Actress and playwright Anna DeVere Smith at KU's Hall Center for the Humanities in 2015. For more, visit our website, newletters.org. A production of New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Today's show was produced with Cassie Vaughn, Danny Moran, Sean Weir, Renita Johnson, and Jamie Walsh. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.